This is a production of Cornell University.
All right, the time is now 4:50, and calling the February 7th Student Assembly meeting to order. Chelsea, if you could please call the roll. Okay, we are moving on to approval of the January 31st meeting minutes. Are there any motions, changes, corrections?
Motion to approve.
There's been a motion to approve. It's been seconded. Is there any dissent? Dissent? No. Seeing none, the minutes are approved. Next is sort of a welcome of potential new members or candidates for the Student Assembly. Is there any, could you raise your hand if you're a candidate for the Student Assembly for, or not candidate, or thinking about coming, becoming a candidate for the Student Assembly? Anyone?
Yeah.
I just wanted to welcome you guys, and I'll also be sort of having small explanations along the way of what we're working on since some of these issues are new. Next is open microphone. Is there anyone in the audience who's not already on the agenda who'd like to speak about any topic? It's like everyone's covered. Okay. So next we're going to go into announcements and reports. Oh. Next we're going to go into presentation by CRP lecturer David West. And Dana, if you could just like give a small introduction and for everyone.
Thank you for allowing me to speak today. I am an urban planner, lecturing in the Department of Community Planning. I'm also a local small business owner.
Do you mind just speaking a little more into the microphone
so sure.
You can hear the outside? Thank you.
I'm hoping to lead a community to change a law that I think is negatively affecting students and neighborhoods. What it is a law that requires construction of a certain number of parking spaces with every development. I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of it, about the movement to get rid of the rule, and about how you guys can get involved. So, first of all, minimum parking requirements, they increase the cost of development by adding additional expenses. They reduce competition in the marketplace among people who are developing housing. They also eliminate small-scale projects, they distort urban form, and they actually create an additional demand for parking rather than reducing the demand for parking. And finally, all this extra parking makes extra driving and achieve the greenhouse gas emissions. Parking can be one of the largest portions of the development, and requiring development of a certain number of parking spaces dramatically increases the cost of development. In Ithaca, we actually have incredibly low vacancy rate, which is defined as a housing crisis. So we have a real shortage of housing in the city, and we're actually putting in place laws that make it more difficult to develop new housing more effectively. So when we look at the annualized cost of developing new parking, what we see is that it's actually much more expensive than it's been charged in rent. So to look at developing a new housing policy on the project that I worked on recently. The cost per space for structured parking, underground parking, would be about $82,000 per space as well. When you break that down over the life cycle of a project, you're looking at about $661 a month is what you have to charge to not lose money on your parking space. But of course, nobody will pay $661 a month for parking space. So what you have to do is you target the market that will accept, and then you end up with a lot. But landlords don't take a lot. No landlord is ever going to take a lot. What they end up doing is they divide that total lot over the number of units, and they pass the cost on of parking to people who live in the building, whether or not they actually have been parking. So even though you might rent parking, all of your neighbors are actually paying for your parking. Right. So, forcing the inclusion of parking, you know, even when it can fit on the site, ends up distorting the reform, doing things that really make it an unpleasant place to walk, to bike. Nobody wants to walk by a corner that is parking. People are looking at these shops and windows. Looking at this, what's kind of interesting is the parking requirements were put in place to actually increase in response to concern over density of college students. If you don't know, people who live around College Town don't like college students looking at it. I'm not sure where they end up with some of this, but it's a big problem. People were upset that there was a bunch of new apartments in College Town, so they decided what they need to do is increase the parking requirements. So they made each developer build some more, which they saw as a way to increase the acceptance of new development, and just wouldn't have it. Unfortunately, what happened is that they made it so that you can only now develop really large apartment buildings, because in order to fit the parking on your lot, you have to buy, knock down 4, 5, 6 houses, so that you have room for parking. So basically what we're requiring is the things that most people would think about, a house surrounded by parking, where the front, side, and back areas are all parking. Giant parking lot where we want to buy a street. And what we're actually outlining is the kind of traditional development that happened in the show before we had widespread cars, and then people generally came into it. Right, so, in planning, as early as the 1920s, there was this idea of the neighborhood. Here we have two graphs, one from 1927 and one from 1997. So both of these graphs are showing our initial neighborhood. We have a school at the center, some retail in the middle, we have some apartments, we have some single family homes. There's a place for everything and everything takes place. Unfortunately, in between these two time periods, the one in 1997 was considered revolutionary because in between here, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, planners thought that suburbia was going to be the cure-all for all of our problems. We need to spread people out, separate people, have our schools in one place, our stores in another place, and our homes in a separate place, to cure kind of the ills that they saw of the post-industrial or post-industrial city. But we realized that wrong. We've gone back to kind of supporting that walkable neighborhood will have a variety of housing options. But unfortunately, our zoning bylaw is still stuck in the 1870s, so that's why we're trying to change it. One of the big things about building parking is that we usually assume, if there's not enough parking on the street, what we need to do is require people to build parking off street. The problem is that the two things are kind of at odds with each other. So when you build off street parking, you encourage people to own cars, which then get used to drive around with it, because once you've invested in a car, you might as well. You've got to go right up there and take a bus to get a car to the driveway. So when you build an additional off-street parking, you actually create more traffic, undermine the road transit, and increase the amount of gas emissions for neighborhoods. Right, it's also the main difference between smart growth and sprawl. The existence of parking pushes apart the destinations that it wants to go to. Even in a neighborhood like College Town, if you have a parking lot and you're building, you can see how the buildings are going to get apart, how it's going to be hard to walk from one house to another and scale that over the entire city can have those dramatic effects. Right? So the impact of that overall, like, as we decrease density, as we push destinations farther apart, and as we make renters subsidize the cost of car ownership, you're damaging transit because you don't have the density to support it. Hardship by walking because you just need a few easy to drive by spreading the cost of the easy drive and no drive. And then at the same time, making the streetscape unsafe and unpleasant for pedestrians and cyclists. Right. So, Fiddlehead is actually has the highest percentage of people who walk to work in the country in the top 10. It's in the top 10 metro areas of people who work by walking. You know, we also have a super high transit usage for our population, so we're a perfect place to start getting rolling back in regulations from the next century. Right now, we actually have a significant oversupply. Last year, I was part of a study that looked at parking in Arlington. We found that in the parking building, approximately 30% of our residents own the car. Well, kept the car, which is an important issue. More people own cars than currently in Los Angeles or Beijing. It's not here. So 30% of people who live in the building with parking had a car. That building is required to have parking for 50% of the property. So, if you want to build a new building, you have to go down to parking, but you're only going to be able to rent 30% at that moment. Buildings without parking actually have like 70% of their options having cars in the car. So, not building parking, first of all, is the best thing you can do to reduce the amount of people who rent parking. And at the same time, when you build a parking, then that additional 20% of the spaces that you build with this call, you can have to rent that. Maybe in communities, that's just like any other people. So the cost of parking isn't only affecting our housing costs, it's also affecting our utility costs. Look at this new goal-weighted parking structure that Cornell just built. The cost per space is around $127,000. So if they were going to rent that out for even a $1,139 a month, which is just never going to happen. So we're just rolling that into the solution. So right now, there's a group of people that are pushing for the community to park in the park. The mayor has the door to the community park, which is the state of the city address. The Cornell Times news was yesterday or today, and a great editorial talking about why we should do it. The vice president of the advisory council and the board of public works, both voting unanimously to ask county council to do this. But in order to get county council, it has to get out of the way. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm asking that people get involved, and there's a variety of ways. First, if you want to follow what's going on at the end of the Facebook page, it's called Parkway Ithaca, and we're going to keep updates up there. The easiest thing you can do is send an email to council@cityofithaca.org. This email goes to all county council members, and it's a great way to get involved. You can also email or give a phone call to people on the committee. You can for instance, like the president of the board, Alan McAllister, Stephen Murdoch, Stephen Smith, and Jennifer Johnson. Now, the first three, I think, are probably the most important of all, if you were thinking about them. Ms. Jennifer Johnson deserves a lot of recognition. She's brought this forward. She worked really hard there and really gets it. But we need some help getting the other members of the council to really understand what's going on. The next meeting for this is going to be Wednesday, February 13th at 6 p.m. in County Council Chamber. This is at the City Hall. It's right on Main Street by the Commons. And the way this works is kind of like today. At the beginning of the meeting, everyone has a chance to come up and speak for 3 minutes. If you go to the Facebook page, you can find, you know, some talking points, there's some videos that give you more information about the topic, and I can help kind of guide your way with this. I'll see if you have any questions. You can post them there, or you're welcome to contact me. My Cornell email is djw267. That's a whole of my presentation today. Oh, I thought you might want to know, if you don't know who represents you in Ithaca, students tend to not vote or not know what the global politics are true. That's not the case in the room tonight, but this is where you can find out what the difference on that issue. Go on the city's webpage, they have a whole new project for all of our representatives. That's it. Thank you for letting me come.
Thank you very much. We actually have two quick clarification questions from SA members, and also as a general rule, today if anyone in the audience has a question or would like to get on the speakers list to make a comment, VP Gitlin is going to be walking around and taking down names of audience members, community members, and how we do it is we do three SA members and then a community member. So you will have the opportunity to speak if you want to. What? And just raise your hand and he'll come back there. So the first question is from Trustee Boris.
Hi, thanks for coming. Thank you for all working with this. I'm 100% on the great initiative. My question is, I've heard the only argument I've heard is that people in the surrounding areas around the health center here at the Department of Sports and then for the long term of this might have a department by the past. So I was wondering if you could say if there are that and B, is there like other obstacles you see or other obstacles so that people are pushing for this, they know what to expect people pushing that from.
Absolutely. So the first question is about people call it skill requirements. The idea that one area is so full, the parking is just spread through the the first problem with that logic is that assuming that people who live on certain blocks have some kind of exclusive right to parking on that block, which city property they don't. But in this event, despite that, kind of injustice of the system, we have something called residential parking permit system. And it basically surrounds College Town. And people on the block, they get their neighbors together and opt in to join the system. And then they all pay $45 a year for a permit. And you can only park on that street at a certain time if you have a permit. Obviously, it's basically the city giving away a very expensive resource at a very low price with instructions about the efficacy of it. But currently on the block, it's very effective. The other thing that you may hear as the objections are that there's kind of a widespread consensus that the parking requirements are actually no longer needed to control parking, but some people are saying we need them to control density. So the argument is that if you remove the parking requirements, people will then be able to add on bedrooms to existing unsafe buildings, or suddenly there'll be a boom development in the whole area on the sort of building, etc. One of the big problems with that is that actually parking is not one of the biggest constraints on development right now in the industry, because again, these are coming from the 70s and trying to create more suburban neighborhood out of our pre-farm neighborhoods. We have requirements for the maximum area of the buildings on our lot, which are usually low, between 20% and 30% for most of them. And so most of those actually are already bigger than the minutes of our buildings. So you can have to build smaller buildings, not bigger buildings. But that is what people are saying. We actually had a 1% majority of them say that people would die because the building is large, so badly maintained, and all of a sudden they're mostly people want to be stuck. But there's just a lot of other control problems in there. There's fire calls, building codes. So really, I think that's one of the big arguments. The other one is that there was a plan to offer developers a chance to buy out their current commercial, called a pilot plan. And most places where they have pilot plans are recorded. You as a developer, you can't fit parking in the middle of their lot. You can pay the city usually about half the cost of actually developing a parking space. for each space that you don't want to build. And then this is going to be that time to build parking somewhere else, maybe a parking garage. In Ithaca, they were really hoping that they could do that much easier for pedestrian improvements. But it's actually really cool to do that. The whole point is that you're getting money from parking to not use it for parking. And it's also a highway that people would pay $20,000 per space to the city, basically, to make it seem like a garage. And the problem is that banks don't like it, because there's nothing that they can take back if your development fails. If you're happy with the building, and you take the city, you know, $1 million in parking fees, and you fail, there's no access to the money. So, power figures really won't work in a city like this. But there were some people who were really hopeful that it could be.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate you coming in. We will send around your email address if people have more questions.
Excellent. I appreciate you.
Thank you. Next, we are going into what? Next, we're going into announcements and reports. The first is a Resolution 15 Green Revolving Fund announcement by Representative Cal's Representative Bailiff. If you could just give a little more information about it for people. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people here know about it because they're especially from Kyoto now. But for people who may not have heard about it in the audience.
Okay, yeah, sure. So last semester we had that suggested that we start to be revolving funds. It's a movement that's happening at a lot of part of the endowment is investing in sustainable projects on college campuses, and the return has been very high, and we haven't been doing that well for those schools. So, Jacob Bryce decided to take one here, and as an assembly, passed it. And this morning, we were saying in another meeting, if the Green Revolving Fund is actually a thing in the future, but then got an email that now later saying that the university is going to give us a $1 million loan to put into the Green Revolving Fund. So it will actually be created in the near future.
And if anyone in the audience is interested in getting involved with that, definitely contact Sarah and Jacob, if you're not already involved. Next is, and congratulations, it's really impressive. It's a really cool, I mean, it's $1 million that the university is going to be, you know, giving for this project. So it's, I mean, it's, I think it's pretty unprecedented, especially on, you know, for that day to work with student organizations to make it happen. So congratulations. Next is an agenda announcement by EPP Muir.
Yes, this is just quick. I also said this last night or the other night in my email. I just did want to reiterate here publicly that it is part of each and every one of our responsibilities to be looking at the agenda before the meeting, reading what's coming up, looking at it, figuring out who you can talk to about things before the meeting so that we spend as little time as possible debating points that are just kind of administrative issues that could be resolved before the meeting. We'll be talking more about that in our executive session today, but just wanted to make that point once again. Thanks.
Next is a Collegetown Community Plan announcement, Representative Iwaoka.
Hi, everyone. So, as I mentioned last week, Ross and I, along with Eric Silverberg, who you might remember, chair of the Collegetown Council, and another member of the Collegetown Council, four of us, working on something we're calling the Collegetown Community Plan. And two major objectives are to create a strong sense of community, such that members in Collegetown can enjoy Cornell life 3 to 5 every day, all day. And the other major objective is to place responsibility on all individuals and actions by giving the community a voice and a message that illustrates zero tolerance bias and purpose. This is in response to what I perceive as a major pitfall at the university, which is Collegetown. You know, we have only 40% of students live on campus and everyone else hugely has been cost by taking a senior year, and yet the university ignores it. And the
Thank you very much. Next, we are going into business of the day, and the first resolution is Resolution 32, Toward a Responsible Endowment, sponsored by Rebecca Macy's, Annalisa Castle, and Sarah Salek. And if you could just like introduce yourself again for everyone, that'd be great. Thank you. We are going to open up the speakers list just to give a another small recap for new people here. This resolution, so we have the university endowment of about $5 billion invested in a lot of different areas, and this resolution calls on the administration to basically divest for the money that is tied up in fossil fuels and invested in fossil fuels to basically call on the university to divest it and divest in other holdings so that it's no longer invested in that by the year 2020. So again, anyone in the audience who'd like to speak, this is now business of the day, so anyone can speak on this. It doesn't have to be questions only. And just raise your hand and Ross will come around and get your name down so I'll know to call on you. So we're opening up the speakers list. Who would like to speak first? VP Smith.
Yes, I thought all right. I agree with this last year. I agree with it now. I think as an assembly, we have a responsibility to be consistent in the resolutions that we approve. We have been, over the past few years, and we have, as Rep.
Representative Valley just mentioned about the big problems that we have been approving resolutions that are in support of Cornell's mission and different green initiatives. So it's only appropriate that we continue that and vote in favor of it. Even if one disagrees with the notion of whether people are causing climate change, not quite sure, but even if you disagree with it, there really is no question that us investing in industries that continually pollute this planet and our environment they are not in line with our own green initiative plans that the president talked about very openly. So anybody else have anything to say?
Yeah,
there are other people who are going to call that.
VP Luke Shadows.
I just want to say that I want to say thank you for spending so much time on this, and then also that I think that by us passing this resolution, it really shows that we are taking the concerns of the students and the concern that the students have for Cornell's need to divest to show that we're progressively acting on our concern for the environment. And while not telling them exactly how to divest, I think that this is a great resolution in really showing what we stand for.
One other clarification for everyone is a sense of the body resolution, which means that we don't, as a student assembly, we do not necessarily have jurisdiction over this issue, but we are saying on behalf of the student body that this is an important issue that we care about and that we want to make known to the administration. Next on the speakers list is Graduate and Professional Student Assembly President Mitch Payton. Yeah. Thank you. And maybe they could also come to the GPSA with the resolution after SA. Next on the speakers list is Representative Kerr. Representative Block.
So I think that would be pretty no-brainer resolution to pass
for it, but I think what's most important is to keep the pressure on the administration. Because once we pass this today, there will be an article in the Sun tomorrow, it sounds like, but after that, what are we going to be doing? And that's the real question today. So we need to get behind this, and we need to start talking about this rather than just passing resolutions and don't solve this problem. Because we really, we should come up with the momentum that we get from this, not just what's happening today.
Director of Elections, Weinberg.
Yeah, thank you. And I really just think very good representative last night. I think one point further, obviously you guys are very organized, very concerned effort, you have a lot of supporters. What are your next steps? You have the support of the student assembly, so assuming this passes, where do you go from here? How does the student assembly help you? And where does the university go? Understanding how there's this well as the student sentiment and there's an awesome school from the street.
That's a great question.
Before I go to the next speaker, is there anyone in the audience who'd like to add anything? Do you want to, so just to make it easier, I'll just call you up to the front. Do you want to come to the front? Yeah. And just, say your name and year for the record.
My name is Catherine, and I'm going to see you. I'm from the team. We're going to be quite familiar with each other. So, I'm just going to try to see the next video.
Yes.
Okay. I would like to stress that I would really need the SNA to find a solution. You all know my very strong feeling about it since we read the meeting last week. I just want to say that the SNA has done some really interesting last year as far as feasibility. The people in fact, I think our freshman in sophomore year, you guys passed water up free campus initiatives. That is something that was not agreed upon by everyone. If you met John Brown, you know that we had a piece of work on it. But it was something that showed the SNA was willing to set a goal that was loftier than we were able to accomplish at the moment. That's something that's very important. We are not only planning for our classes from ASCA, and if we set high goals, then the data can be as good as we can. That's something that I would still get to see happen in a lot of free initiatives that I'd like to see happen in the future. I think this is a perfect opportunity for you guys to show that as a university, we expect Cornell not to do any of this in any profit, but trying to show that our actions are aligned with our values and that we don't only have education and climate action plan that we put our money into our mouth.
Thank you. Next is Representative Iwoko.
I agree with everything that everyone said, maybe some of the lessons were wrong said, but primarily everyone. I'm very much in favor of the resolution, and I think it's time to call the question.
Second.
We have a couple more, we have two more on the list that I was going to go down, but do you want to keep the motion out there? We could vote to vote if people. Okay, so we're going to vote on whether we vote on this now. It's just a procedural thing, whether to end debate. So if you're in favor of closing discussion and voting on this resolution right now, please raise your placards. If you, if you're not in favor, if you want to continue discussion, please raise your placards. Abstentions. that have to be two-thirds? Not two-thirds. Right.
We're just calculating the math here. Sorry. Hold.
What?
Yeah, so by a vote of 13-7-1, that the motion doesn't pass, so we're going to continue debate on the resolution. And next is VP Breeden.
So I had a comment. Originally last week, I was out of 50-50, and to be honest, I was more leaning towards the side of I don't think we should have that at all. That being said, I think it speaks volumes that the administration is willing to delay.
Thank you.
Rep. Pritchett.
Thank you guys very much for your support and for your help. To kind of along the lines of what Rep. Lott and the rest of the other things that I have, I'm really uncomfortable that this is under the 30s or something. Specifically, for instance, the body, I'm not personally comfortable that we as residents of funding are knowledgeable and not necessary to make a recommendation to Cornell County. I mean, for example,
I'm also going to be a little more of a stickler about time limits.
I thank you very much for coming in. Wonderful to be able to truly care about me. Having the university responsibly handle its affairs. So my question is primarily about the specifics and the last, be it therefore the overall philosophy. Why 2020 and why 30% specifically? I'm no expert on divestment reinvestment, but why exactly do you think that there's a benchmark, and do you think that it actually enhances the credibility of the resolution to specifically say those two?
That's the end of the first speaker list. Is there anyone else who'd like to speak before we move on to the second?
Hey guys, thanks for coming. The intentions behind this resolution are amazing. So I'm glad to see that there are students here passionate. that said, I guess just to echo Representative Frisch's concerns, I have no knowledge of how to invest funds or, well, anyone to have a little bit. I guess I'm fearful that, you know, by 2020, ExxonMobil will still be the largest, you know, corporation by assets. Moving away from companies that will provide us with good returns on our investments. So, you know, maybe sustainable energy is a better alternative. But, like, why, do you know why that a small portion of our endowment is currently allocated towards sustainable energy if that's the case? And, like, yeah, if you could just answer that question.
Well, first, again, I'd just like to point out that the resolution is not only in terms of the body of it, but even though it is in it, is deliberately vague as far as how to divest. I mean, the economic community is being updated with Dan, and we've also provided in other reports suggestions for where to start with divestment. For example, the sort of list of the circulation around the country, but I think at least 15 of these three schools have already divested. The list is very negative. They call it 12 to 15. So the 15 most damaging causing corporations should have to be given their so that's one strategy, right? There are several ways. But we're not prepared either to tell them how to do that. But we are following basic steps and major cuts on it. So the following leaders are peer institutions. I mean, this is a really good question. We get the experts to invest, but we're sort of losing the economics to do that. And then, sorry, I think we have a
question. No, that's enough. Thank you. That's time for a question.
Sorry, you have a second.
There's been a motion to vote on the resolution. It's been seconded. Is there any dissent? Seeing none, we are going to roll call on Resolution 32. Oh yeah. So actually, before we do that, because there's a sense of the body resolution, according to the Student Assembly Community Clause, members of the audience, community members, have the opportunity to vote, and the cumulative of the audience's vote counts as two votes towards the total roll call. So did you explain that to everyone when you were around? Okay. So we're first going to ask the audience basically what they, you know, how they would vote on this resolution. So those in the audience, if you're in favor of Resolution 32, please raise your hands. Okay. And if you are, what? If you're not in favor, please raise your hands. Any abstentions? One. So that goes two to
yes, right.
So that's going to count as two community votes in favor of this resolution. Now we're going to roll call the essay. So Chelsea, please call the roll.
Yes. By vote of 22-2-0, Resolution 32 passes. Congratulations. So now just the process for what happened so everyone knows. We're now going to email, officially communicate
Resolution 32 to President Scorton and the appropriate administrators, and because the Student Assembly is direct sort of communication to President Scorton, reports to President Scorton, and then they have the obligation to respond back to us with their answer within 30 days. So thank you very much for coming. Next on the agenda is Resolution 33, reaffiliating Ivy Council with the Student Assembly.
I thought they were all very good.
Oh, you mean everybody's not here for Ivy Council?
I don't think so.
I thought they were here for Ivy Council. That's going to be on the record.
What?
That's going to be on that record.
Guys, focus. Everyone else is getting up, speaking of people. Enrico and Sarah, if you could, if all Student Assembly members could take their seats. All right, Cameron, you have 2 minutes to present. And also Jeff.
And that
going back to that conversation about how we're going to start the meeting. So the other project is basically, I think, for programming decisions of service for students that would be able to be engaged with the community and the respective schools. So that would essentially give us opportunity to engage with service for students. And so I think that in terms of what the president wants to function as, it would definitely be, you know, not just that, you know, they think that they would provide the leadership that can be
contemplated. And with that, I'll share that summary, the reason why I'm important to have to be related to each other specifically as an official activity. And there's also an attached letter from Nick Jefferson, who represents the entire Council of Force. So currently, I didn't have the purpose of the Council of Organization. And currently, the board now is the only delegation that does not have any kind of related to the agenda, and which is counteractive to what the current position of writing is. So, in short, we are not serving the purpose. Second, as the judge stated, we believe that any council will serve as a legislative research body for the SA. If you look at the future orientation section, Ivy Council is working on having formal policies on these issues, which these individuals are responsible for corresponding to the student governing body of each Ivy school, and based on that, our students are based here at Cornell, we'll be able to make more formal and better recommendations on how we should guide the environment. And then thirdly, funding. I'm kind of annoying again. At the conference this fall,
there is a motion to move it to business of the day. There's dissent. I'm going to leave it as new business for now, just because you're still mid in the presentation.
Right. So hopefully you guys have been able to read the report. I would say that I really want to obviously make adjustments to the business department. Yeah, I'm not here, but this is extremely important.
Thank you. First on the speaker's list is Rep. Kerr.
So, we will be looking at setting up the community that we serve underneath the community government, similar to And I believe that my leadership position really in specific specifics. So, for example, having policy questions, which the curriculum is very small, donation that should be represented in each school. But those people would be looking what they're studying for, like policy meetings. And those would be the people who are in studying for that conference classes here at Yale. And they would be there for research purposes. So, exactly, you know, writing down the issues that are in some schools.
Sorry, you have ten more seconds.
Oh, okay.
You'll have more time to answer questions. I was just for this specific question. Yeah. VP Gitlin. VP Breeden. And we're in questions only. By the way.
Like Cameron mentioned, I was co-chair for my class last year, and I think it's a pretty unique organization just because it's our ID. That being said, one of the things that I was really interested in your report was reasons why I counted should be a part of that. I understand funding, I understand the purposes, but the thing I'm most interested in is the legislative research body. You mentioned, the possible liaison of the High Council trying to institute. So my concern is that that's largely unprecedented, and if we be reaffiliating High Council with the SA, there wouldn't be any apparent add value if that had came to fruition. So please talk more about the policy liaison, how you plan to go out and recruit a process, what that actually entails, and your relationship between High Council and the SA.
All right, that's a great question. I think that, first of all, since your fantastic internet and the design of my project, one of the things that is one of the most significant things that we have in the organization is there's a much stronger relationship between all the IDEA schools. Justin and I participated in a weekly conference with GS Sky, and of course, we will chat with and so what we're discussing is kind of go back to the question that what form of being placed in the policy is not together. And so what we're working on as an example leadership executive board is a formal database where all student government, policies, and student government students are working on will be available to all the ideas. And so, by adding infrastructure such as that, by having a stronger relationship between the head of the primary school, I think it would be easier to possibly gather information and bring that back to our system.
There's been a lot of talking and sort of smiling. I don't know what the side conversation's about, but if you guys could just keep giving them respect, I'd really appreciate it. Thanks. Next on the speakers list is Rep. Gracia.
Serving
Just to recap for everyone sort of in the audience, what we're debating right now is Ivy Council is an organization that brings together all the Ivy League schools and puts together these conferences to share ideas and to collaborate and to sort of kind of as a think tank in a lot of ways, in addition to other functions. And we're debating right now whether to make this organization a part of the student assembly as a committee so that it's kind of like any other one of our committees, like dining, like residence life, like women's issues, and that's sort of the debate that we're having right now. Point of, yeah.
So why is it that you're funding because it's not a student organization? Otherwise, is it not eligible to be a student organization?
I'm going to direct that to Rep. Pritchett.
Currently, one of the problems that we're going to get to now is we weren't actually able to use the resources because the Science Council was not a registered student organization. It was originally slated to the community, so therefore we weren't able to have these vehicles. But since it was unaffiliated, it was not any sort of organization at all, I guess. And so we weren't eligible to receive funding for the
community. What's your question?
I'll put you on the speakers list. And I'm also cutting you guys down to 30 seconds speaking time, just because we're running out of time for the meeting. Next is VP Luke Shevitz.
Hi, so I have two questions. The first one is how much is your funding? How much funding will be needed? What was the cost like last year? What did, and so on and so forth. And then my other question is, regarding what the committee would do throughout the rest of the year. If we look at all the committees right now that are under the SA, all of them are working on, have a variety of different initiatives that they're working on, and they produce resolutions out of those. And so while I realize that this body, this committee would be looking at policies that other schools have and corresponding with other student governing bodies, I think that that is fundamentally the responsibility of every single student that is a sponsor of a resolution, that it's their responsibility to look up what other schools are doing. Yeah. So my question is, what would the committee be doing throughout the year? Michelle and Shia have mentioned
Rep Block. Next is VP Smith.
So most of my questions have been answered. I just kind of wanted to respect
two or three
numbers. That's probably more information. So just over the past week, how many people have been involved with IB Council, and how big are the delegations that go, and how do those delegations and continue this throughout the year? How does that compare back up to our peer institutions?
So, in terms of the IB Leadership Summit, typically the large corporations are Brown and Dartmouth, because Brown has a number of commissioners actually described as the commission. Again, it's going to be focused on more IB Council and Dartmouth is the same time as the entire IB Council of the government. So, in terms of number, in your question, that is a
there's been a motion to table, excuse me, till next meeting. Is there any dissent? So basically tabling means they're just going to take the week to do a little more research about it and basically speak to some SA members outside of the meeting. And it will come up next week as business of the day, which means it can be debated. That does not mean that, you know, SA members don't like the resolution. It just means we'll talk about it sort of offline a little bit more, and you guys will come back and regroup and present it again. Cool? Seeing no dissent, this will be tabled until next week. Next is...
thank you for coming.
Next is Resolution 34. Oh, did you... want to say something?
I'm on the
Oh, okay.
Jessica, you can stay too if you want. Jess, thank you very much. We really appreciate it. We will. I will. It's going to be business of the day, but I'll take these four names down, and you can be top of the list next week. What? He's fine with it. Next is Resolution 34, Amendment to Appendix A of the Student Assembly Charter. You guys have 2 minutes, 2 to 3 minutes to present this. Just one thing before they begin. For everyone in the room who's just running, Byline-funded organizations, they are the 30 sort of largest organizations on campus, which get all students pay the student activity fee, which is $230 out of your tuition. And that money is then allocated by the Student Assembly Appropriations Committee. And that's allocated to the 30 largest organizations on campus, Slope Day, CUEMS, Concert Commission, one of the SAFs, the Student Assembly Finance Commission, which then distributes it even further to another 400 to 500 organizations. So right now they're going to be talking about rules about reviewing those 30 organizations. And although it kind of seems like sometimes boring or just kind of like paperwork or like we're just discussing something, in reality the process, and this is for SA members also actually, in reality what we're discussing right now has real effects on Slope Day, on Concert Commission, on, you know, all of these organizations that students are going to and affect the quality of student and fun of student life of students on campus. So you guys have a couple minutes to explain the resolution.
Yeah, and this is even present earlier, there's nothing more about this money. With that said, this, as you know, this decision is a non-finance funding so next year, at this time, we'll be funding over the allocating to the next year $6.5 million for various projects and conditions. What legislation is that? This proposal essentially accomplishes two things. First, with every group that we see during appropriations committee, we're not during the financing cycle. The appropriations committee needs to maintain, decrease, or increase on the recommendation, along with the report that the chair of the appropriations committee has made. Then, the second part, this is pretty much just proof of the relationship between the five.
Okay, we're going to open up the speakers list. First is Representative Block. And this is questions only. And this cannot be moved because this is a charter change, so it requires at least 2 weeks on the agenda anyway.
So thank you guys for coming to the meeting. This is a very radical change to how
give him a few more seconds.
And secondly, that we have created a committee to give them recommendations and we can follow our recommendations. So, yes, my question is very simple. What is your policy on how many influence the non-violent funding year appropriations committee should have on the violent funding appropriations committee for the next year?
No, I think for your question, Jeff, I'm glad you asked it. Whoever the future vice president of finance is going to be is. That person, I think, would definitely benefit from all of the information that we possibly can. So, say, for example, you're the vice president of finance, and we read up all the support, we want these recommendations, and then the follow-up committee also has this recommendation. Maybe that means you're the vice president of finance, and you have a lot of information. You can choose whether or not you want to follow it. That's your decision, but you have the information, additional knowledge, and you can have free. And in that respect, I think it's only for the benefit of that last one.
I'm going to move on to the next one just for time. Rep. Kerr. Next is Trustee Boris.
Awesome. Hey guys, I have a number of questions, but I think they're all in regards to the discussion about you guys. The first is a good question, but you'll have to refer to this just to talk to the other
people.
Okay, it's Tom, I gave you that comment, that's all. So the questions are, first, if this is changed this year, how does that affect whether Romeo is applying for a new job? Like, are you going to now try to have all new meetings in the next semester? Or, like, what's the plan of completion now if you have a certain? The second question is,
such a good point.
If you could just talk a little bit about
it's social.
Early in the Wear Act clause, it talks about how currently groups are required to meet the appropriations committee, or they're supposed to have check in meetings, and then you're changing the charter now requiring that they meet with it. What are their current actual requirements? Like, is E1 will change? And if so, how do you plan to implement that? Do you plan to give like a specific calendar for groups so they don't need it to approve, like what's enforcement? Just kind of like a little bit about that process.
So to address the second question first, referring to E1, if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that the appropriations committee already meets with all of the guidelines and recommendations for non-funding cycles. Again, I'm not 100% on that. And then for the first question, I'm going to hand it over to you.
Can I have a quick question? How does this affect the remaining compliance with the number of subscriptions? We're going to have all these meetings and this and that, whatever it is, something that will take effect on the legal
conference.
No, I'm sure we're going to speak the project for the project. One of the things that will be scheduled with the Navy organization this semester. If you could just go a little more into maybe whichever question is the other one. Which is, how do you plan on enforcing this? What does the state look like? I mean, especially if you're doing this and that, so that you're going to be pretty tight deadline, or you tell people to do this, you can come in and you're not getting a job at all. It's a simple kind of question. Don't think of the meeting is what is the plan? And second of all, how do you plan to schedule this?
I would say it's the last organization that has interest to meet with the appropriations committee, when it's not during the cycle. That's already kind of in place. That's something that's been going on for, you know, how many other years, that's kind of say. So with that said, the schedule is up to the discretion of the chair of the appropriations committee. That's definitely a question that we will bring up to the meal, and something that I can do to improve the stakeholders for next week or the following.
Next is Chelsea, Clerk Chang.
Offline with the organization.
the appropriate committee to have.
Next is Rep. Bonatti.
Thank you for coming. So I have some questions regarding the first one is transparency. In your clause E2, at the bottom of the first page, you have that order reports of the other version of the previous committee. I was wondering if this is also available to the rest of the assembly of this, because of course there are all the lists here, and the government committee controls most of the finances of the government to provide. So I think there is more option and more information on the committee for everybody to get some input. And the second one, I was just asking about regarding experience. Of course, we all know that the people in the experience community, about half of them are voted by us, and the other one are getting handpicked by the VP of Finance. I think they're only this question. So I was wondering, like, what kind of experience do, you know, these members have to, like, recommend decisions to balance the negotiations that have been operating for years?
You could wrap up the question.
So to address this first question, have access to this information? I would say no. It's not necessary. I don't think the marginal benefit of follow-up asking for recommendations to the student assembly. That's not a benefit that and then addressing the appropriations in that respect, I don't want the appropriations to be what is directly or indirectly allowed to the student assembly to represent the student assembly and therefore the entire current population. So I don't see the necessity of that additional level of bureaucracy.
And to address your second question, express concern about whether or not an individual would be qualified to give recommendations to the organization of operations. Well, that's what the purpose of the appropriations committee is. We are not experts, but finalists for organizations are receiving connectivity from all students, and there have to be a group of students who will hold them accountable to the standards that's set by the student body. So I think that by having a task force, we're not imposing on the will of the student organization. If anything, we're giving them more leeway and more understanding as to what their organization's needs are and their functions are, so that we can see if the appropriations and these recommendations are actually feasible and reasonable for their organization.
Motion to adjourn.
There's been a motion to adjourn. Before we could do that, this has to be tabled.
I table it.
There's been a what? Do you dissent? Do you withdraw your motion for him to? So we're gonna vote to adjourn to table or not. What? We're gonna have more time to discuss this. There's a good chance we won't even vote on this next week. So I promise that people will have as much time as they want to ask as many questions as they want about this resolution, and it won't be rushed through in any way. Is that okay? Okay. We are adjourned. We're going into executive session, which means all non-SA members, thank you very much for coming. We really appreciate it. Email us if you have any questions about running. All SA members, please stay for executive session.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.